I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Thomas Pangle, professor and Joe R. Long Chair in Democratic Studies at the University of Texas, Austin. We're discussing his recent book, The Life of Wisdom and Rousseau's Reveries of the Solitary Walker, from Cornell University Press. Pangle works on ancient and modern political philosophy, American constitutionalism, and the dialogue between political philosophy and political theology. He has published 14 books and many journal articles and book chapters on these topics. Okay, well, first of all, Tom Pangle, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tom, this is a fantastic book. I've very much enjoyed reading your take on Rousseau's Reveries, especially because this summer I've been reading Rousseau's Reveries, spending some time with it, talking about it with graduate students, and it's been great to read your take alongside Rousseau, which has very much enhanced the experience. So thank you for the book. Can you start by just talking a little bit about what motivated you to write this book in particular, talk about Rousseau and the Reveries in particular? Why did you write this book?
Well, the book is in a way a sequel to my previous two books, which were on Xenophon's Socrates, both the Memorabilia and the other shorter Socratic writings. And that, of course, expresses the fact that the ancient political philosophers made the life and the soul of the independent rationalist philosopher exemplified in Socrates the supreme source of norms for political philosophy, for humanity's moral as well as civic existence. In medieval philosophy, that was all eclipsed by the phenomena of the prophets and the saints. And on the peaks of political philosophy, the modern Enlightenment, from Machiavelli to Montesquieu, the life of the sage remained in eclipse, although perhaps, you know, the exception being Montaigne, but an odd exception, until Rousseau. Rousseau restored this classical centrality of the life and soul, sagacious individual, himself exemplifying it, as supremely normative for political philosophy. And he thereby invited, it seems to me, close and searching comparison and contrast with the figure of Socrates, as portrayed in the ancient Socratic text, to which Rousseau repeatedly refers us and looks back. And in Rousseau, I started the study really I want to really understand as much as I can and help others understand. So what is the Rousseauian alternative, so to speak? And putting that in dialogue, as I think Rousseau wants us to, with the Socratic. And in Rousseau, I think it's fair to say the life of wisdom takes on a profoundly unsocratic, self-consciously Socratic character, which I think expresses his profoundly unsocratic and even anti-classical conception of human nature. And that is, you know, centered on a radical individuality, which Rousseau's speculation conceives as rooted in an original natural condition of radical solitude, lacking any clear specific directedness to a maximal fulfillment, as we find in the Socratics and their understanding of the philosophic life. And in seeing the human being as endowed instead by nature with a radical malleability or so-called perfectibility, that in the historic acquired social condition of alienation from nature seeks ultimately not the Socratic life of sustained philosophic scientific progress in deciphering the puzzles of nature, but instead finds satisfaction in an unthinking enjoyment of sweet, solitary, or at least private sentiments, feelings. Above all, the sentiment of existence, a timeless state of conscious suspension, a loss of sense of time, and thus mortality. But also the sentiment of romantic love for a single member of the opposite sex, and also imaginative creation of societies of close superhuman friends, and also an awed sense of a union in solitude with nature as a divine whole. But then also of engagement in engrossed amateur hobbies, the exemplary being field botany, and of contemplation, especially in one's old age, of one's own past life with a view to one deserving and therefore expecting or hoping for a continuation of these sentimental enjoyments in an incorporeal life after corporeal death, deserving it because of a life of goodness, if not virtue, consisting especially in compassion and generosity to one's fellow man, refraining from active injustice, respecting and supporting virtue, civic and moral, and the political freedom it brings, all of this resting on a strong upholding of retributive justice. So that's kind of the, you know, in a nutshell, the what brought me to this and where I wound up.
Yeah, that's good. Can I just probe a little bit more on the, you know, the overall picture here in terms of the, you know, the Socratic model of the philosopher versus the Rousseauan model of the philosopher? It's interesting because I talked to Larry Cooper just recently about his book on the Reveries, and he claims that Rousseau is more consistent with the Socratic tradition than you're claiming. So let me just say, maybe sum it up Larry here for a second, which is, I guess, I mean, there's a, I guess to bring up a well-worn contrast, there's a Platonic Socrates and there's a, you know, a Socratic Socrates, as it were. You know, the Platonic Socrates is the one that, I suppose, you know, aspires for the kind of, you know, absolute or comprehensive knowledge of being. Whereas the Socratic Socrates is more zetetic, and is more animated by the erotic and the interpersonal. Isn't there a case, I guess, to be made that, you know, that the Socratic Socrates is a little bit closer to Rousseau as portrayed there? What do you think about that? Why is there something to that?
Well, I guess by the Socratic Socrates you have in mind, especially the Xenophontic Socrates, who certainly is all said by Hegel, by Nietzsche, by others to be the more authentic portrait of Socrates. And certainly, that portrait lacks the metaphysical, and to some extent, going along with that, the transhuman erotic character of Plato's presentation of Socrates as a teacher. But I don't think there's any indication of a Socrates who did not think that the life of rational, sustained thinking, especially in and as a meditation on constant dialectical engagement with others in rigorous self-critical and critical arguments, especially about our deepest attachments and concerns, constantly revolving questions and answers about those. I don't think there's any indication that that is the central part of Socrates' life. Certainly, he did a lot of solitary thinking as well, as is indicated, especially in Plato, I would say, but also in Xenophon. But that solitary thinking was, I would say, rigorous, rational, critical, dialectical thinking, not sentimental in the Rousseauian sense. And on the contrary, it seems to me Rousseau stresses over and over again, thinking is not what is the fulfillment of life. And thinking indeed eventually is a corrosive of what is deepest and most satisfying and sweetest about our consciousness. So I think Rousseau was a great thinker, and his great system, I think, was an extremely powerful and rich alternative understanding of human nature. But I think in his own mind, his understanding is that is all a kind of ladder by which we ascend, or maybe you should say descend, to the truer self that we are, which is not a thinking in that critically, constantly dialectical, analyzed sense, but a feeling being, and a feeling that is above all rooted in one's individuality, one's distinctiveness. And I think that would be another dimension, it seems to me, of the great difference, that I think for Socrates, as a rationalist philosopher, what is most important is the universal, the common, the nature of humans as a species. Whereas Rousseau, I think, ultimately thinks, no, that's important and we need to understand it, but so that on that basis, we can each, so to speak, take flight in our own trajectory.
That's great. That's really helpful. I mean, one of the very helpful things about your book is, you know, distinguishing Rousseau's ideal from the Socratic ideal on the one hand, and then on the other hand, maybe I ask you to say a little bit about, again, by way of introduction, the sort of contrast between the, you could say, the Rousseauan sage and the kind of religious prophet, right? Because that would be the other contrasting figure, I assume, here, right? Yeah. So one of the things that occurs to me in reading through the Reveries is there's some ways in which there's a resonance with the religious Judeo-Christian religious tradition. Rousseau portrays himself as this great, you know, he's rejected out of society. There's like a Job-like character to him he encounters universal suffering or Jesus, you know, that, and it's through suffering that he comes to a kind of enlightenment. So maybe you could say a little bit about, you know, the continuities and discontinuities, I guess, with the religious tradition that Rousseau seems to be developing a distinctively modern as opposed to ancient or Christian view here.
Yeah, well, I think you've hit on a lot of the really important highlights of that. I think that's very true, what you just said. I think he does see himself as a Job-like and even more a Christ-like figure. Not that he thinks he's a second Christ or anything like that, but that he does, I think in Jesus as presented in the New Testament, there is a portrait of the kind of wisdom that comes through real suffering and real compassion with the suffering of others, which Rousseau himself feels he, to some extent, recapitulated with, you know, without any claim to having the kind of access to the divine that Jesus had, of course. But, and I think here another very interesting contrast with Plato comes in, because on more than one occasion, Rousseau says that in a way, the deepest point in Plato is his portrait through the voice of Glaucon in Book Two of the Republic, of the just man who is stripped of everything but his justice and who winds up tortured to death and, you know, scorned and so on. And Jesus, at one point, that's a portrait of Jesus in a way. In other words, he thinks that Plato had a divination of something that he couldn't, of course, have access to, but he saw, yes, there's this human archetype, if you will, that Rousseau, I think, feels, you know, he himself lived in a certain way wasn't sufficiently appreciated by the ancients and even Plato, who glimpsed it. So yes, I think that Rousseau does think that in the fullest case, recovering one's individuality for a person such as himself is going to require going through hell, is going to require a real disentangling that is going to be painful and is not going to be well accepted by others from social conventional ties and attachments, while still feeling the compassion and sympathy and trying to make constructive moves, especially in writing, to help others and not become misanthropic.
Right. The distinctively modern character of Rousseau's image of the sage seems really right to me. I was wondering, you know, in terms of the modernity of it, whether, well, let me put it this way, that, you know, it seems like the Socratic sage tradition and the Christian prophetic tradition are kind of, you know, aristocratic traditions in the sense that they're a kind of rare achievement for human beings. I wonder if, you know, for Rousseau, a modern character of his view of the sage, is it more democratic? That is it more accessible to a wide swath of human beings, the sort of sentimental attachment where, you know, we're all sentimental beings. We're all in some sense attached to our own being. Is there, I wrestle with this text with the Reveries in the sense that it's not clear to me whether Rousseau is suggesting that this is an ideal that's accessible to everyone to a certain degree, or whether it's like the, you know, more ancient traditions that it's only accessible to the few.
I think you're right when you're in your sense that Rousseau seriously believes and certainly wants to some extent, project the teaching that to some extent this is accessible to, if not everyone, it's possible for everyone to give it a try. Not that everyone is going to go through the whole Rousseauian evolution and construction of understanding of nature and so on. They can take some of that from Rousseau's more philosophic writings. I also think he thinks there's a simpler, more direct route to a kind of self-discovery, which can come through private love and affection of family and of another person, or memories of a love affair that was, you know, the greatest thing in one's life. And Rousseau very much encouraged ones to embrace it. Don't say, oh, I'm going to forget that because it makes me sad. Embrace it. That was you. And of course, he writes an old man. And I do think he, part of this book, The Reveries, is meant to be a kind of model or guide to old people. Look back at your life and see what made you deserving of self-respect as a decent person. Meditate, contemplate that. And that goes with his, you know, pretty strong suggestion. There is an afterlife and there is a judgment, and you don't have to be a hero or a saint to make it. You just have to, you know, be a reflective, decent person who tries to put together their life as it comes to its end in a way that is, humane and respecting of others, compassionate, but also trying to be your own person through your feelings more than your excellence of mind, which I think Rousseau does think is very rare. So yes, I think there is a real, maybe you could say egalitarian, democratic, popular, perhaps would be the best way to put it, a popular side to his presentation of being a sage. And there's a fragment of his letter to Beaumont, which I quote in my preface to the book, in which he says, I can't make people politically free. That's not going to be possible. I can explain to them what political freedom is, but it's going to be very rare. But I can help them to become wise, even in their servitude. I can help them to become sages. And I think that unwritten fragment is an interesting disclosure, I think, of the side that you've asked about.
That's great. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about the text, The Reveries. I was wondering if you maybe could set the context a little bit for The Reveries as a text, in terms of, as you mentioned, this is, it's written by Rousseau when he was old. It's his final text, right? So yes. Maybe you could say a little bit about the text itself and how it fits in with Rousseau's corpus and his life. It's an autobiographical work of a sort, and Rousseau wrote a few autobiographical works before that. So maybe tell us a little bit about the context there.
Right. I mean, his later works, after most of his political theory works and more philosophic works, are very autobiographical, especially The Great Confessions, which is a long work, but which only takes him up to, you might say, the threshold of old age. Then he wrote, as the second to his last great work, a very strange work called The Dialogues, Rousseau Judges Jean-Jacques Dialogues. And it's a conversation between a man named Rousseau and a Frenchman who are arguing over how do you judge Jean-Jacques, who is the real Rousseau. It's a strange house of mirrors. And clearly Rousseau seems to be saying that the guy called Rousseau is partly me, but he doesn't really fully understand me. And the Frenchman is a typical reader who thinks, oh, this is an awful person. He's heard a lot of terrible things about me and so on. And so it's a curious kind of indirect self-revelation, if you will. Then his last work is The Reveries. And this is a much shorter work. And it's much more expressive and direct. And Rousseau is always talking to the audience, except he begins the work by saying, I'm never going to write for anyone else again. I'm only going to write for myself. I'm never going to publish this. But this turns out to be somewhat playful. And it's pretty clear that this is, again, a kind of a bit of a house of mirrors where he's claiming, I'm never going to let anyone read this. And he's always thinking of how people read about his dialogue with himself. So it has a very complicated and somewhat labyrinthian character for that reason. You always know Rousseau is talking to himself, but you also quickly begin to realize, and it's kind of like a soliloquy stage. And by the way, he wrote a number of plays in his youth. And one of the features of his playwriting was he loved soliloquies. He loved to have his characters talk to themselves on stage as if they don't know that anyone is listening. So I think it's a soliloquy, good way to understand at least a large part of the character of the writing of this book, The Reveries. And since it was written right at the end of his life, the first seven of the 10 chapters or walks, as he calls them, he copied out very carefully in beautiful handwriting. So we have a very good manuscript of that. The last three are much more written clearly as a kind of not quite final draft. And you can see it's the writing of a very old man with a shakier hand and so on. So the book has these two parts, and he died really days after finishing the last. And so many people think, well, he was going to write more probably, or the last, which is very short, is incomplete. I'm trying to think it's as complete as one can expect. Maybe he would have written more if he had lived another year. But I think the book as it stands is a pretty complete work, and that he had pretty much said what he had to say. So I think it is a real work in itself. Although it is also true, another little complexity, there was a pack of playing cards. In those days, playing cards had the figure on one side and a blank on the other. And he wrote a lot of notes on the backs of those playing cards, which apparently were written at the same time he was writing The Reveries. So some of the little notes he writes there are also interesting lights on The Reveries. And so that's often referred to as well.
Hmm.
Hope that helps answer your question.
Yeah, that's interesting. The notion of Reveries, I mean, you talk a fair bit in the book about the very idea, the concept of Reveries, I guess, in Rousseau's title. And you have a helpful appendix on the use of the term Reveries in the French language at the time. I mean, you could say a little bit about, you know, the use of the term Reveries and what you take it to mean, the kind of multifaceted meaning that it has in Rousseau's corpus.
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the hardest aspects of trying to understand this work, because Reveries is manifold in its meanings, and the meanings evolved somewhat in Rousseau's writings. Prior to writing The Confessions, which, as I said, was this, you know, earlier, longer work, he didn't use Reveries much. And in The Confessions is in sort of two volumes. And in the first volume of The Confessions, he seems to use Reveries almost entirely to mean what we would call daydreaming, sometimes erotic daydreaming and fantasizing of a lighthearted kind of, you know, playing around at your desk, doodling and so on. In the second part, the Reveries start to get much more serious. They become deeper, more deliberate ways of getting in touch with yourself, of getting in touch with your deepest feelings, of remembering things that you really want to recollect. And then in the dialogues, that penultimate work that I mentioned, and in the reveries, they, so to speak, explode in significance. And it turns out there are several very different types of reverie. There's the reveries, which he attributes especially to his youth in retrospect, of imagining himself as being what he hopes he will become, sometimes a warrior, sometimes a shepherd, sometimes a great writer. And those he has a great deal of respect for as something that he didn't maybe respect enough at the time as expressing who he was then. But later in life, creative in a deliberate way, he, as he became more and more disenchanted with his social attachments, he began to create images of societies that would be ideal friendships and lovers and company of a private sort, not political, but smaller groups of human beings. And then he even talks about celestial superhuman beings. In other words, humanoids who would be better than we are, who with whom he could rediscover a higher and purer level of relationship. And this became a very important part of his life, this kind of very creative. Another kind of very serious reverie is when he's out in nature, finding himself discovering a sense of unity with nature, of a not of a philosophic rationalist thinking, but of a more sentimental feeling, getting in touch, as we would say today, with nature, and sensing behind it some kind of divinity, some kind of purposeful and knowing. Not human, but humanly appreciative being in and behind nature. And then there are reveries that become more and more inner directed. And these are those that he makes the very peak of reveries, where he's all alone in a place of tranquility, of quiet, within nature, next to a babbling stream, or lying in the bottom of a rowboat out in a lake, or simply sitting down in a meadow and pulling himself into himself, or letting himself drift into himself, into a deep, introspective, motionless or sustained sense of suspension, tranquility. And that seems to be a recovery of the original natural condition, of course, of a much more developed mentality. So there are very different meanings given to reverie, and I haven't mentioned all of them, but that's some of the most important. And it makes it, therefore, a term that is so multivalent that one has to always look at the context very much. Now, what reverie are we in here? What are we talking about here now in terms of reverie? And sometimes it glides from one to the other. So that, for example, he gives a very beautiful portrait in one of his very autobiographical letters, which was deliberately meant to be published, of how he slid from his great creative reverie of the society going, and there was a party, and they were all. And then he said, I began to feel terribly uneasy about the fact this is, after all, just my imagination. And I slipped into looking at the world around me, and I began to realize in that reality, there's something more beautiful, deeper, get in touch with, and then this kind of union with nature as a whole and the sense of a divinity behind it takes over. So there's a way in which the reveries can, so to speak, meld into one another in, of the different types.
Hmm. Yeah, I was wondering if there's any way to see some unity among the different notions of reverie there. I mean, it strikes me that, at least in part, it's meant there's a contrast of, category, which is that of reason or thinking, right?
Yes.
Which he often contrasts, and that reverie is the opposite of that, that it, unlike reason or thinking, which sort of seeks out, universal categories and is a gentle in the sort of, activity, invoking human agency. This is, reveries are sort of passive and individualized, expressing a, you know, like immediately apprehending a whole rather than a, you know, it's like Kantian intuition as opposed to, you know, discursive reasoning. So I don't know if that's on the right track, but I'm not sure if there's a way to think about the kind of general way of bringing together some of these different notions.
Yeah, I think that I think that is the right track. That it's by way of contrast that I find most helpful. Contrast with philosophic, analytic, scientific, dialectical thinking. I mean, the reveries are never conversational. He never has a reverie with another person, not even with his beloved. When he thinks of their love affair together, he makes it clear. In fact, it's a very dramatic statement, Confessions, where he says, when he was on his way to re-meet the woman he was in love with, he says, I didn't have any reveries. I didn't need them because I was all engaged in, you know, I'm going to meet the woman I love and, you know, I don't need to dream now. And so at that point in his life, he's sort of ranking reveries below the wonderful experience of a love affair, of an erotic love affair. And I think he never entirely gives up on that rank. The last chapter of the Reveries, the last thing he ever wrote for publication, at least, he speaks of that love affair long ago, the greatest thing in his life. And he doesn't even mention Reveries. So I think it's another indication of the fact that our nature, so once we've left the state of nature, once we're in society, really is manifold. It has different directions one can go in, and it's a mistake to go in just one. And reveries themselves are multi-directional. And so there is individuality, but part of individuality for Rousseau is its multiplicity, if you will, of possibilities, which can be experienced in sequence independently of one another, or in a kind of series that leads one to another. And so I think, but coming back to what you were saying, I think that the contrast helps, because it's not that he ever looked forward to some kind of Socratic dialogue with the woman he loved. You know, it was much more being together in a sub analytical sub questioning, and much more, if you will, emotionally positive way. The reveries are, in contrast to, I think, Rousseau's understanding of serious thinking, is always drawing back and asking, what is happening to me? Or why did I do that? Or what is the broader significance of this? Or how does this reveal human nature in general? And all of that, Rousseau thinks, is very important to do. And he did it very well and very deep, published great works about it. But as I put it earlier, it's more like a kind of ladder that you need to use to get to a place where you're not going to do that anymore. Not because you think it's not of great, something you respect and is very needed for us once we're social beings, as we have become historically. But it's not the purpose or the goal or the fulfillment of our human nature and its existence, as it is for Socrates and the ancients. And I think the reveries are to be understood as different important manifestations of that contrast.
That's great. I wanted to ask you about the structure of the work. How to puzzle through. I mean, I think, as you said earlier, it has the appearance that it's a kind of, you know, melange of different, you know, occasional reflections, memories. Occasionally there's this philosophical analysis of lying. But, you know, so is there a good way to think about how the structure, the developmental structure of the work? I think at one point in your book, you describe it as a kind of dialectical development of Rousseau's thinking. We could expand on that.
Right. And when I used the word dialectical there, I meant it more in the Hegelian, not in the Socratic sense. And what I mean by that is, the book is dialectical in that I think the different chapters or walks, as he calls them, often can be understood, one giving a certain point of view, then the next one saying, yes, but there's a contrary point of view that's also valid that must be then, you know, looked into. So that, for example, in the second walk, he tells about his the degree to which he was his life was overshadowed by the thought of death, and the thought of death as something you know, grim and frightening, but somewhat to a decisive extent consoled by the thought of an afterlife under a just God. The third walk then, in a way, gives you a spiritual autobiographic portrait of Rousseau. He says, all right, let's sit back and talk about my whole evolution in terms of how I think about divinity. So I think that, you know, that's a way in which the walk then, you know, picks up from the second walk and says, yeah, but we can't leave it there. We have to now explore, how did I get to this position about divinity? And what are all the twists and turns? He was once a Protestant, then he was a Catholic, then he was, you know, a member of the Philosophes, and then he, and so on. And he gives an account of himself that is very much what you might call the religious side of Rousseau. Then in the fourth walk, suddenly turns to the classical side and says, Plutarch is the one book I've always learned from. It's the only book I've always picked up and found out something about, clearly implying that isn't true of the Bible. There's something about classical thought that has to be brought in here to counterbalance what I've just told you about my religious development. There's also a development of me as, you know, very much following Plutarch and Socrates and thinking of myself as wanting live in Plato's Republic. So he goes very far, you could say, in the classical direction in the fourth. And part of that is his exploring the question, why, if I'm so concerned with what I call goodness, compassion, being, you know, fair and respectable to one's fellow man, why do I lie so much? What is my non-truth telling all about? Why do I, you know, tell myself and tell others things I know are not true? When and where can you do that? So there's, as you were mentioning, this very elaborate and very philosophic account of truthfulness. What is truthfulness? When can you tell a falsehood, when not, and so on. So again, a kind of exploration of a question anyone might have after having read the previous chapter or walk. So there's a way in which I think the work unfolds in this kind of back and forth way. Here, let me tell you about this part of my life. All right, now, having told you about, focused on that, I must tell you about a very different part, which is, you know, to some extent in real tension, but I think it's not contradiction and so on. So I found trying to figure out, why does this chapter or walk need to come here after the previous one? And then why and how does it questions that we get answered or at least dealt with in the next one is I think the key to understanding how the work is put together. It's kind of unfolding back and forth with the reader, in a sense of yes, I know you have that question. All right, let's get in.
I see. So it's a little bit like, I guess, a hermeneutic circle in the sense that it's a deepening of Rousseau's self. Is that the way to think of it? That there's a yes. Kind of each walk sort of deepens yeah. And broadens Rousseau's self, so that ultimately you get this portrait of a self that has a kind of interlocked structure of as we would expect, very you know, the tension ridden contradictions with any self that he's giving a portrait of it. So that's, I see.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the one thing I'd add is I think ascends to a kind of peak and then descends. And the peak is his portrait of himself recovering what he calls the sentiment of one's existence. And that's when he's alone on an island in Switzerland I mean, there are other people living around on the island, but the moments when he's alone for a whole afternoon, sometimes sitting in the bottom of a rowboat, sometimes just sitting on a hill looking at the mountains and discovering this deep inner reverie, self-awareness at this sentimental, not self-critical level that I've spoken of before, that I think he means to indicate is the real peak. He feels that's the moment, or those were the moments, and similar moments at other times in his life, but he gives us a portrait of that at one time when he feels he was most deeply satisfied, so to speak, if you will, most fully who he was, if you will. Then he turns to things like his botanizing, this actually amateurish but very rich hobby he had of looking for plants, collecting them, and trying to understand them, and so on. So there's a much more active side that sort of then complements the much more inner passive side. Excuse me. And then the book moves in the last part towards his more social side and his loves and so on. And his wife appears more in the latter part. So there's a kind of ascent to his most inner, private, personal sentiment of himself. And then a descent to, yes, but there was this other part of me that's loving and caring and, you know, not simply solitary.
I see. That's last bit is great, because it strikes me in thinking of the overall structure. I mean, it begins with a couple walks that really are portray Rousseau in a state of feverish amour propre, right? To use his own terms, that he's very much concerned about how he's universally reviled by society and how this is a huge injustice, et cetera. And then the ascent tour,
as you interject. I just want to interject that. That's another interesting sort of the overall way the book moves. It starts, as you say, with extreme expressions of alienation from the whole human race. They've persecuted me. I've broken with them. I'm never going to talk to them again. I'm not going to write for anybody. And it ends with this account of his love affair and saying that was the most happy time of my life, and I always remember it. And so he ends by calling himself a truly loving soul. And so you have this remarkable contrast beginning to end. And I think it's again, part of this character of the book of you see one side, but then you must look at the other side, that if you just are looking at one, you say, he couldn't possibly be the other. Oh, yes, he is the other.
I mean, one other way I was thinking was in terms of that there's a way to address the feverishness of amour propre and turn it into a loving amour propre with another person, but you have to go through the kind of development retrieval of one's amour de soi, which is the sort of middle parts, that it's only through kind of retrieving that authentic sentiment of existence in oneself that then one can then reemerge back into society and be that, you know, a loving, find loving friendship, right? I don't know if that's if that's a way to think about the overall structure, that any individual person in modern society is going to be consumed by amour propre, and to find genuine friendship, you need to follow Rousseau's path. What do you think of that?
I think that there may be something to that, or some version of his path. I think he certainly encourages a real withdrawal into oneself from competitive, vanity-ridden worry about how you are appearing to others and so on, one aspect of that is if you can find someone, a kindred spirit, and have a friendship or love, that can be very helpful. But maybe you won't, and then you're going to have to do it on your own, so to speak. But yes, I think he presents himself, I think, as someone who has experienced a kind of extreme, he doesn't expect or hope other people have to experience, of a need to withdraw, and in effect indicating, but you'll have some version of this if you're really going to be who you discover who you are.
Right. There is a theodicy character in a way, well, to Rousseau's thought in general, that the sort of amour propre can be problematic to the modern age, but it also can be redeemed. And here he's portraying it in his own life, that it has this extremely, it caused him great suffering, but it also was an occasion for him to be able to withdraw utterly. That sort of utter solitude was made possible by his utter abandonment from society at large, right?
Yeah, I mean, he certainly, I think he, if one looks at his actual life as a biographer would, and there have been, you know, there's a good biography of him by the political theorist Maurice Cranston, which I think is a very good biography. One sees, I think, he exaggerates the degree to which he withdrew, you know, that he was, at least in his middle age years, when he was doing his greatest, you know, most popular writing, the Emile and the novel Nouvelle Héloïse and the Social Contract and so on, was a much more socially engaged figure, much more concerned with his reputation as a writer. And of course, he also wrote some great music and opera. And so that part in the Reveries, he very much almost squirrels away, certainly in plays. You could almost read the Reveries and think this is the only thing the guy ever wrote, apparently. He refers to its confessions a little. He refers to dialogues a little. He doesn't say a word about his great works of political theory, and only about the Confession of Faith, Savoir Vicar, a small part of the Emile. And he refers to that as if it's a standalone work. He doesn't really talk about it as it's a small part of a long philosophic novel. So there's a way in which the whole Reveries, I think, is Rousseau presenting himself in a way that is more imitable by other people. In other words, you don't have to have written The Social Contract and The Second Discourse and so on to begin to think, might I live a version of some of what Rousseau is showing me in the Reveries? Good, so it's a strange autobiographical work. It's the autobiographical work of a very great and very influential writer who presents himself in such a way that you could miss that unless you knew about the other works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. So we've been talking a fair bit about, I think, the first several walks and the concluding 10th walk. I wanted to hone in a little bit more on the middle walks, just and get your take on say the 5th and the 6th walk. The 5th walk, the sort of middle here, the peak, as you mentioned before. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about Rousseau's account of happiness or fulfillment that's sort of centered on the sentiment of existence, which is a, you know, crucial Rousseauan concept and makes its appearance here in the 5th walk. It seems to me there's a tension in the 5th walk and also in the 7th, where he also revisits the character of happiness with regard to botany. But Rousseau talks about on the one hand, a kind of dwelling in the moment, love of you know, the imminent sentiment of his existence and desiring it to last forever, but on the other hand, a recognition of the flux of existence, that everything is in constant becoming, everything's constantly changing. Nothing, so no happiness, finally can be had on earth. So there seems to be a kind of a tension between what Rousseau aspires for in the philosophical life and what seems possible. I mean, you're very well attuned to this in your analysis. Maybe you could say a little bit more about it.
Yeah, well, I think you've started to capture the essence of it, and I have to immediately say, I don't think I've ever had the experience he's talking about. And so I feel a little bit like someone, you know, looking through the shop window and knowing I can't buy that. Well, I'd like to have it, but I don't think I can get it. Because the fundamental experience is one which sort of is looked back to from a sense of the flux of all things, as you put it, is looked at as a time when I didn't feel that, when I really felt that I was simply in suspension temporally, that there was no time, that I was just wholly within myself, and he calls it a godlike experience. And I think he means that kind of seriously, that this is sort of, you know, kind of like Augustine's definition of eternity. It's not time forever. It's above that. It's out of time. It's being that is not becoming. And I think Rousseau seriously claims that there were, you know, times in his life when he experienced that. And that's the deepest sentiment of existence. So I would call it being in being and no sense of becoming. Now, it doesn't last, of course. You get a bit, you know, the wind blows, the tree shakes, and suddenly you're back looking around and you realize I'm in the temporal world. And then you have a kind of regret. So it's an evanescent, paradoxically, an evanescent sense of permanence that he really longs for and claims is achievable. And as I say, I'm in the unfortunate position of never, I don't think, as far as I know, having gotten to that. I'm in the flux. And I think, you know, he's pretty serious about that. You don't have to be, you know, I think he would say to me, try it, you know, try to come to the experience and maybe you'll make it, but you have to, you know. And he says quite strongly in that walk, he says, you have to make an effort. He said, you just, you know, drift into this or expect it to come to you. And so I think there is a kind of incentivizing of saying, you know, that he wants people to try.
Right. So it's an attempted communing. I mean, he gives a couple examples of how he achieves this, I guess. I mean, maybe say a little bit about that, but I mean, one is, you know, he's floating in a boat or, sitting by the shore with the waves lapping. A little bit later, it's with botany. I don't know if you think that that's the, you know, brings him the same kind of character, but you know, what is it that we have to make an effort about? Is it the kind of, you know, a purging of something? I mean, is it more of a negative kind of character of resisting some of our urges, or is it a kind of letting go into existence? What's the recipe book here?
I think there's some overcoming that's needed or resisting, but I think that's quite preparatory, and I think it's more a looking for and finding moments when real calm and tranquility is possible. and this he stresses quite a bit, when there is some kind of sensory input, if you will, that is regular, mild, and soothing in its repetitiveness. So the, you know, the gentle lapping of the waves on the shore of a lake, the gentle burbling of a brook that you're sitting beside, the gentle wind in the trees, something that is like a rocking, if you will, like rocking a baby, if you will, some kind of motion paradoxically is needed as the context for experiencing the motionless or atemporal sense of permanence. So I think he indicates our soul is so constructed that we've got to, in a way, divert our temporal awareness. We can't ever escape it. We have to have some motion going on, but it has to be the kind that is background, you know, that can be completely background. I guess, you know, these sound machines now that people sell that you wear in an airplane that gives you sound that drowns out all other sounds but doesn't really attract you in any way, and therefore you can just go to sleep. Rousseau, I think, might like that. That, yeah, okay, let's try out to go to sleep. And this is one other thing I think that is important to bring in here. He very much stresses this is not falling asleep; it's wakefulness. And not getting confused with it being a kind of stupor, or you know, a kind of soporific. That's not what he means. It's a very alive sense of one's being, oneself. But it is transtemporal, if you will.
Right, and I think that last point for me is crucial in reading this, because it's Rousseau emphasizes a few times that what he's noting is the expansiveness of his self. This is something that he's noted in the Emile and also in here, that there's a kind of the self seeks to expand itself over all of nature. And so at least it seems to me one of the reasons why, you know, that the kind of repetitiveness of nature and examining plants rather than animals is so satisfying is because those things don't resist the expansive agency of oneself. Like, you know, trying to animals at least present some resistance to your expansiveness, right? The plants don't. So that, I don't know if bringing in that sort of expansive character of the self, that's he wants to expand it over all of nature, right?
Yeah, certainly a strong element in Rousseau's understanding of human psychology, of saying we are by nature, we want to expand. And he even, I think, shows some, you know, incipient indications of that in his vision of the solitary state of nature. There's an activity and a pleasure in activity of that. So I think he thinks that's really very fundamental, elemental. How exactly it fits with the sentiment of existence, I'm not so sure. I'm not sure he ever really explains that very clearly. Certainly it's very present in some of the versions of the reverie, such as, you know, when he feels a unity with the whole of nature and with the divinity that's behind nature and so on. That's a very different thing from this going into oneself and feeling a godlike sense of being, you know, completely within and satisfied by oneself. So I guess I'm inclined to think the expansiveness and the full sentiment of one's own existence in the bottom rowboat or whatever are somewhat opposite or different poles of our psychology. And the one has to be given up when you move in the direction of the other. A little like the reveries of creative sociality, creating wonderful societies that have never existed, has to be given up when you go into the form of the reverie of the sentiment of one's own existence. So there's again this back and forth of different aspects of our psychology. One thing that has to be mentioned, which is very puzzling, is this. In the reveries, he doesn't mention it, but in the confessions, when he tells about the same time he spent on that island where he had the peak experience, he was always with a dog, and the dog was with him in the rowboat. And he even says in the confessions, I couldn't stay in the rowboat too long because the dog would be restless. So he was never completely alone, it turns out. Although in the reveries, he presents himself as if he was. And that makes me wonder, and I say this in the book, is it possible that in the reveries, he is presenting what I call a kind of utopian vision? That, in other words, this is something he, so to speak, asymptotically approached, but maybe himself never completely experienced. Now, maybe this is my weakness. I'm saying that because I haven't ever completely experienced it. And so maybe I'm being a little too skeptical here, but I was just very struck by realizing the dog is not in the picture here. What happened to the dog? And he, you know, he really liked dogs. He had a pet dog, different pet dogs, of course, at different times in his life. And he always speaks very well of them and always says, you know, we were always partners. I was not his master. We were friends and so on. So he had a very egalitarian relationship with these dogs. And that's just a side of his character that I think has to be kind of into the picture.
That's good. Okay, well, I have my weekend project. to go out to nature and try to commune with it. I'll leave my dog behind. Maybe you could do the same, although it's 105 degrees here, so I'm not sure if nature would provide me with the same satisfying experience. Let me just conclude by just asking about the sixth walk, because here you get a turn from, as you point out, his view of happiness to his view of goodness. And it's a puzzling walk for me because it's, there seems to be a kind of turning away, certainly from the ideal of the social contract and even maybe the meal. In the sixth walk, Rousseau talks about how he finds virtue burdensome and unpleasant, because virtue, of course, in Rousseau's view, requires a kind of sacrifice or discipline of the inclinations, which are for Rousseau in any case some good. And so he'd rather be good than virtuous. How do you think that this account of goodness kind of fits in with his overall picture? It's certainly very divergent from a kind of ancient tradition that would emphasize virtue. So that's, I think, well taken. But is there a little bit of an irresponsibility here? I mean, there is something that's a little bit irksome about Rousseau talking about how he finds it burdensome to give charity to this child who he comes by every day, because he found it eventually kind of it was tiresome, because he found it, he was doing it out of virtue rather than just out of a natural pleasant inclination.
Yeah, I think he himself indicates he worries about what you call the irresponsibility, both in being simply good and not virtuous, and maybe even more talking about it so much. Because, of course, in talking about it, he kind of induces or promotes the idea of that other people don't need to be virtuous but should try for goodness. I think that that's somewhat deliberate, in that I think he thinks in the modern world we probably have a better chance of having what he calls goodness than having virtue, since virtue is so political. It depends so much on being a citizen. It's not impossible by any means, and I think he still tries to support it wherever it is possible, like in Poland or in Corsica. But I think he's willing to be, maybe more honest than as responsible as he would have been in a different historical epoch, in ranking virtue below goodness. And I think he does have a real respect for virtue. And I think he's being quite honest when he in effect says, I don't have the strength of character to be that, to do that. On the other hand, I don't think it's completely natural. And I think I'm a more natural human being for not having it. But I do think he thinks that a historical construct, if you will, it can be a very successful way of making human beings maximally self-sufficient, independent, and free within a very socialized setting, which they're not naturally inclined to. So I think it is I think you're right to say it is a very problematic part, I think, of his thought as a whole, and also of that sixth walk in the Reveries.
Well, that's great. Well, Tom, this has been really illuminating. Definitely, I said my weekend project was going to be communing with nature, but it might be to turn back to the Reveries and read it again. Maybe that would give me the sentiment of existence better than going to nature would. I'm not sure, but in any case, let me say thank you so much again for joining me on the Political Theory.
Well, thanks very much for the opportunity. I've enjoyed it, and it's been very thought provoking.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.